Thank you very much, Professor Cornea, and it's, I must say, a real pleasure to be here, not only to be in Florence, but to especially to be in this classroom, as we have been working somewhat in parallel for many, many years. And I have to say, a bit of the parallelism became especially apparent to me a little earlier today when Professor Cornea gave me a copy of this book, Towards Human Development, which is subtitled New Approaches to Macroeconomics and Inequality. And I just want to warn you that if you're tempted to follow either of us into this field, you are really venturing into the wilderness, because there is no such thing as the macroeconomics of inequality so far as, for example, the official codes of the Journal of Economic Literature are concerned. It's not a recognized area. Perhaps with a bit more effort, it will become so. It may be becoming so now, thanks to the celebrity of Professor Piketty, who seems to have at least raised this question of the link between inequality and macroeconomic phenomenon to a very high level of visibility. I am going to be talking in part today about the burden of evidence that bears on the relationship between inequality and macro phenomena. And I will, I think, eventually be able to say something that may be relevant to one of the key Piketty theses, which is that there is a long-run tendency under capitalism for inequality to rise because of a tendency for the rate of return on capital assets to exceed the rate of economic growth, and therefore for people who own capital assets necessarily concentrated in a small part of the community to have a more rapid rise of income than people who don't own capital assets. That's at least a very short statement of one of the Piketty theses, although he does allow for a significant exception to it, which is the 20th century. One of the questions that I want to be able to address is where does the evidence lead us if we want to examine carefully the extent to which economic inequality has been rising over some significant part of the modern period. For that, my approach has been above all oriented toward the production of a usable and relevant body of data. And what I want to talk about today is primarily a data exercise, so it's going to be a great many of slides on this screen. But I'll tell you a little bit about the data set to begin with, and I can explore it after I've shown it to you. We can explore a little bit more if you're interested into how it was actually constructed. This is a data set that we call EHI, that stands for Estimated Household Income Inequality. It's income inequality is what we're attempting to capture. It's household income inequality instead of personal income, and it's estimated. And estimated is important because we're not actually measuring income inequality. This is not based directly on survey information of households' reported income. The difficulty with the survey literature is very simply, surveys are expensive. They may or may not be conducted in any particular country in any particular year. So if you look at the record, it's scattered. There are lots of gaps, countries and years that are missing. And it's also the case that there's no high commissariat that tells you what to measure. So that sometimes people are measuring gross household income inequality, sometimes they're interested in net household income inequality, sometimes they're interested in personal income inequality, sometimes they're interested in other concepts. And each time you change the concept, although all kinds of questions of equivalence scales on which researchers have had different points of view, each time you change the concept, the resulting measure changes, and it's not, and one has to be very careful at the least about comparing one thing to the next. It's also the case that this is a research project which I undertook without any money.
Welcome to the club.
Yes, well, that's a very important consideration. If you don't have any money, you can't simply go out and start collecting raw data. You have to find a body of information that you can obtain very cheaply, let's say a few hundred dollars, and that from which you can calculate inequality measures just by handing a graduate student cups of coffee. Right? That's been my approach for many years. The graduate students are extremely good, and they have been able to do something quite interesting with a very large range of data sets that come essentially from administrative sources. What we realized was that we could calculate an inequality measure using the tile T statistic measured across categories for a wide range of information sources, geographic categories, industrial sectors, and in particular, if you want to restrict yourself to manufacturing, industrial classification schemes in manufacturing. And it's very simple to do that. Question is whether the information that you gather is any good. And that's the question that we addressed. What we did was to take a data set calculated for the first time years ago, now in the early 2000s, from the United Nations Industrial Development Organization's industrial statistics across manufacturing sectors, and a big panel of these components of the tile statistic, and we decided we'd just take a then current data set, the predecessor of the WIID, namely the Dininger and Squire data set that was produced in the World Bank in the mid-1990s, match up countries in years, and run a regression and see how closely they corresponded using logarithms so you get elasticities. And what we did with that regression was to control for three types of major categories of Gini coefficient in Dininger and Squire, whether it was income or expenditure survey, whether it was household or personal, whether it was gross or net. And then there are just two other variables in the regression, one of which is the share of the manufacturing employment in total population, easily calculated if you have population and some payroll data. And the other one is our little tile statistic, or the logarithm there on this equation, this variable here. And what we discovered when we ran that regression, matching over, in this case, this is the updated version, 430 observations that were exactly matched, that we were able to pick up over half of the variation in the Dininger and Squire set, and that the relationship between our measure and that measure, once you control for the type of variance, is very tight. So, turns out a movement of our measure produces a movement of the Gini coefficient about 1/10 as large. Very nice. So now what we do is we set all of the controls to zero, so we're now talking gross household income inequality, and use these two coefficients and compute a large panel data set of estimated Ginis. That's all. It's one simple model that uses a measure of pay inequality from an administrative data set to, in effect, guess what a particular consistent concept of household income inequality probably is. Okay, so advantage of it, if the data are any good, is you get...
This is for all the countries in the world or only for data?
It is for 149 countries. Taking just staying ahead of Professor Cornea by a fraction of a second, at 3,871 country year estimates, which, if they're any good, again, is a lot of estimates, at least to have, of an entirely consistent character, which raises the question of whether they're any good or not, and I'm going to come to that question because it's a difficult question. But before we do that, I'll show you some numbers that you can't read, but it's a pretty chart. So Gini coefficients, this is for maybe 25 or so of the countries, and scale with the blues representing measures in the 20s and low 30s, and the reds representing, I think, it's about 35, and the degree of color representing changes. So if you wanted to get close to this, you could pick out what was going on, but the main point of the chart is that this is pretty dense. There are a lot of annual measures for a lot of countries, and the whole world, actually, if you do this panel for all 149 countries, there would be a lot of these numbers, the coverage. So the coverage is really pretty good, again, if the numbers are any good. So let me talk a little bit more about what the measures show. This is just maps done by another one of my talented students. And in order to permit me to summarize things, what I've done here is to give you a color code, so very simple stuff. So over the 1960s, this is the decade average where there are observations. Some countries we don't have any yet. And if it's a low inequality, it's a dark blue. Up to the light blue is a Gini coefficient of 35, and from 35 onward it runs into the hot colors. And a very simple pattern emerges. The rich countries have lower inequality than poor countries. Not a big surprise, I don't think. And it's true that the northern countries of Europe and the eastern countries of Europe have lower inequality than the southern countries of Europe. Again, okay. Sort of passing the common sense test. The question then would be whether these measures vary over time as we go decade by decade, whether you continue to have good coverage and whether you continue to see things that seem to make sense. In the 1970s, in particular the US, you see a measure going up because the United States was experiencing a series of oil shocks and recessions. Decade of turbulence. You move on to the 1980s, filling in a little bit in Latin America with some very high inequality countries along the Pacific Rim, hot increases in South Asia. China appears for the first time as a low inequality country in the 1980s. Move into the 1990s, and of course we get data on former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. Latin America fills in as a very high inequality region. No particular surprises here. We move into the 2000s and you get and continuing increase on a decade basis in Eastern Europe. And by the end of the period, one has measures of inequality which are as low as they were generally originally, only in a handful of places. I can see Denmark, Sweden, and Finland on this map. Substantially higher in all of the other industrial countries for which we've made calculations. The Eastern European region has become a relatively higher inequality region, as has China and so on. That's the picture as it appears from a very sort of preliminary examination of the evidence. And you can see, of course, that apart from sub-Saharan Africa, and parts of North Africa, the coverage is pretty good. Also a lot of smaller countries that are not going to show up on this map, but that's the They're not inconsistent with the climate change.
Even have children, I have a low inequality country right here in the Caribbean.
We're not lost for long.
Well, yeah, that's we're monitoring the Cuban situation.
What about Germany?
What about Germany? Why is Germany not on that map? You do have data for Germany. It's a good question. I will show you Germany momentarily. It may be simply a geographic. I'll have to reg that in stern terms with my very talented student who's from Poland. It's possible that it might be a Polish thing. But I suspect it's simply a geographic coding question because the codes change when Germany is reunited. Anyway, if you just take a mean value, which is not a very informative thing to do, but it gives you an idea of this macroeconomic question. There's some movement up and down in the 60s. I'm not going to pay much attention to this because the composition affects countries coming into the data set, particularly poorer countries come in and see the numbers go up. This is year-to-year data. But there's a distinct decline in the 1970s, and then from 1980 on up into the 1990s, it goes up. The peaking there is artificial here. That's in the early 1990s. Why is that happening? Because we're adding in transition economies that didn't previously exist as separate countries, and so the mean is coming down. I haven't corrected for that, I could. If you did, what you would get is a sweep from upward that starts in 1980 and ends about 2000. It does end. It's a 20-year thing. And right there, I have a suggestion which we can explore more, which is that things which happen over 20-year periods are probably not inevitable long-run consequences of capitalism. My common sense intuition is that 20 years may seem like a long time to you, but when you get to the extreme antiquity represented at the front of the room, well, you know, it's not so long. And I remember what happened at the start of that period because I was the staff director of the Joint Economic Committee of the U.S. Congress. And we were overrun by the galloping legions of the Reagan Revolution. So the fact was I got demolished and the inequality went up. And of course the same was happening in the United Kingdom. It was being spread all through the world by the extraordinary, well, I would argue, what happened was what's the force impelling global change in the early 1980s? High interest rates and debt crisis. And so this gives me an argument, which is not necessarily inconsistent with Piketty's R greater than G in some broad sense, but suggests that R value is not some fundamental fact of the capitalist system, the rate of return on capital, but rather the consequence of central bank policy in the dominant countries spread out and impacting anybody who borrows in the dominant currencies. And if that is true, then what you would expect is that inequality would be rising most rapidly in countries that we know were afflicted by the debt crisis, Southern Cone, Latin America, for example, parts of Africa, South Asia, but that it would not be rising in this period so rapidly in countries that were isolated from the international financial system, which you might think in the 1980s would be China, had no external debt, would be India, which controlled its external exposure, it would be Iran, which was in the middle of a very egalitarian revolution, whatever else you might think of it. So we can test those propositions and look at them. I'll get to that substantially later. Okay. This is the piece that is new. And it's very long, and it's very noisy as information. Question that we were trying to face was, okay, how do we make an honest assessment of the quality of our data? This is like comparing a vast number of observations with an even vaster number of other people's observations, including the WIID, including the Fred Salt synthetic WIID, and Professor Cornelius addresses a scowl, including whatever we could find. And I have, in particular, I have two very talented students, but I have to mention one of them by name especially, is Beatrice Halbach, who just is a marvel of methodical ransacking of this literature. Goes, finds the articles on Country X and copies down every single number and then methodically notes what that number is supposed to be, where it's from and what concept is being used, what equivalent scale and so forth, how the thing is described in literature. And then we did some color coding, and the color coding is, the black is always us, that's our number, the time series. The green is when the concept is market income. The blue is gross income, which is the same general concept as us, but somebody's actual measure of it. Red is net income, yellow is consumption, and purple is, well, the literature is not easy to read, and we sometimes can't figure out what exactly it was. So something between blue and red, maybe, would be it give us purple. Particularly, this stuff is in all kinds of languages, and it's not entirely always clear to us exactly what is meant. What do I mean by market income? Well, I'll show you what I mean momentarily. I should just say there's so many of the SWIID, S-W-I-I-D, that just use light dotted lines, so you can find them on the charts without them being visually dominant. So their first group of things I want to show you are estimates that we think are pretty consistent with the literature, namely the collection of stuff that we found in the wealthy countries. Let's start with Canada, and I'll get to your question. So here's our number for Canada, our numbers. There's the blue ones are other people's gross estimates. Ours is pretty much in the center of those. The total span is about 16 points here. And the trends are all pretty similar. So we argue that our estimate is not implausible for Canada. It doesn't go in some weird direction. It's not way out of line with the other data. When you look at Fred Salt's stuff, we've got data out here that are measuring things that nobody else has, so it's hard to know what to make of it. The green, you can see, are market income. What is that? That is the inequality in income of that part of income held by households that comes from pay or presumably capital, labor or capital. Right? It's spectacularly unequal. Right? And we're going to see that pattern. It's the first very interesting finding. We're going to see that pattern throughout the series for advanced countries. They all have this very high inequality of market income. Now, why is that? A spontaneous answer would be, well, capitalist countries are very unequal. And then they have big welfare states, which reduces the income inequality by, in this case, so as much as 20 Gini points. I don't think so. I think what's actually happening here is advanced capitalist countries have a lot of households that don't have any market income. And the reason for that is that they have other kinds of income, namely pensions, social security, and so forth. And therefore, they can form independent households and live on their own without relying on someone who has market income. So we've got to remember that household formation depends upon income sources. It's not entirely independent. And those numbers include a great many households who report zero, like everybody over the age of 65, let's say, or a very large majority, who are still living in independent households, have no market income at all. They're living on public pension. Something classified as something else, all right? And of course, that's going to make a big difference in inequality. Yeah. Yep.
What about maybe them? So, because there is wealth inside the mathematics, right?
Say what again?
About them, mortgages and so on. So, are they considered negative income or?
No, debt would be negative wealth.
Negative.
So yeah. It would
but
be.
Pay interest on it.
The interest on it is an expense, so that's not going to be your income number either. And a debt crisis, an increase of debt is going to be consistent with growing incomes, its effect on distribution is not clear, as the rich and the poor can both take out loans. So I don't see any way really I haven't got a way to immediately answer that question. Maybe something will come to us as we look through the data. At this point, I'm just trying to give you what seems to me sort of basic common sense of the numbers for a country which is supposedly modern, with a very good statistics Canada. And yet you can see, even for a consistent concept, large differences in the inequality measures, depending upon the details, the source maybe, or some aspect of the calculation. So that's the first thing to notice about the literature. Here's Denmark. Yeah.
Why don't you go back?
Okay.
Now,
we'll be here all night if we stay on Canada, because I got about 40 countries to show.
Okay, but now which line corresponds to, let's say, gross income? Let's say both wages, capital income, and pensions before taxes and transfers.
Okay, so here is something that's identified as the DNS-LIS household gross. So LIS is, I assume, Luxembourg Income Studies. That would be these triangles here. Not far off from ours, I'm pleased to say. I love the LIS. It's meticulous. My number hits the LIS number within a few Gini points, I'm a happy person. I'm not concerned about being off by a couple of points here. I'd be concerned if I'm off by 20, if I'm going in a different direction. The LIS, you can see, because it's so meticulous, it has large gaps. The numbers are good, but there are only a few of them. And then you have like CanSim, personal income total. We distinguish between households and personal. So this is a personal number, that's a household number. And you can see the difference that's associated with that. It's all, I think, basically sensible, but you really have to have a trained eye. Lesson number one, there is no such thing as a country's Gini coefficient. The World Bank publishes, the World Development Indicators, a table of Gini coefficients. Good luck. I mean, one has to know exactly what concept you're dealing with, or it's completely meaningless to compare them. So here's Denmark, another allegedly orderly small country you can see for yourself, a lot of different measures that vary for some of the same reasons. And even in Denmark, substantial disparity between quite high market income inequality, and of course very low, almost the lowest of the data set for the low measures of disposable income inequality. Our measure seems to be right in the middle there. France, the French have not been good about maintaining this kind of record, and the data is much spottier, but there again, there we are. There's Germany. So we do have the data. That's not on the map, I'm not sure. Our measure for the Federal Republic closely matches a gross income measure, which is Kruger GSOET. And here you have the late unlamented German Democratic Republic, also named UDC. That's the lowest inequality measures. Whether they're any good or not, I don't know, but they're the lowest ones in our data set, suggesting that I've sometimes said that zero inequality is for the graveyard, and that might have been the experience of the GDR. Yeah?
Would we expect, you know, that the average aspect of the unification would be significantly different from the...
Yes, I would have thought so too. So I don't have a good answer why not, except of course that in the initial unification they raised the income scale. So it's interesting that the German data, let's go up here, don't show a big jump. It's not just our data that don't show it, nobody's data do after unification. They do show an increase over time and peaks in just before the crisis. But characteristic, interestingly, our data are not different from the others in that respect. So Greece, data are messier. again, I could say we're roughly consistent with other measures of gross income inequality. Let's go through. There's Italy. In Italy, there's not much of the way of marking of gross income measures. Ours fall roughly between they fall to the top end of the disposable level of marking income measures. We pick up the decline in inequality that is consistent with what other people find out through the early 1980s. There's Japan, there's the Netherlands, there's Spain, there's Sweden. Big increases in at least some measures of inequality running out past where we have an estimate. There's the United Kingdom. I just run them by you, and there's too much detail we could spend a lot of time on. But I would just suggest that for a very simple model, take our estimate, our measure of industrial pay inequality, and multiply it by a coefficient, add another coefficient relating to the degree of manufacturing industrialization, which is a pretty stable number, and you hit the mark, at least for the advanced countries, quite closely. The mark is they're trying to match the black to the blue. Not too bad, and the degree of change is roughly consistent. What does that tell us? I would say that it tells us that household income inequality is perhaps not always, but often, pretty closely associated with the structure of pay. And that the structure of pay in industry is a pretty good marker for the structure of pay generally. So the idea, if I could just draw a typical distribution on the blackboard, is that we may be picking up a piece of it. We're not getting poor people who work in the service industry, very numerous. We're not getting the investment bankers. We're getting the industrial workers. But if this distribution changes and becomes, for example, more equal, then that part of the distribution becomes more compressed relative to what it was before. And so we're seeing, essentially, it suggests that there's a kind of macroeconomic unity to the movement of various measures of income distribution. So supports the idea that we've got a macro phenomenon working at the national level. I'm not going to be content with that. I want to ask whether there's a macro phenomenon working at the international level. I'm going to come to that. But first of all, the U.S. The U.S. is another place where there are a lot of data sources, a lot of little variations in what's being measured. But it's also a country where our measure is not especially close. At least it's good up until the early 80s, or maybe what's the number, what are we looking at, up to the early 90s. But then it falls below, by a noticeable amount, other people's measures of gross household income inequality. And it doesn't pick up that peak and that peak. This is the CBO before tax inequality, and the one below is the other bumpy one is the CBO's after-tax inequality. So what's going on? I would suggest that our measure is probably pretty good as a measure of household inequality based on earnings, but the U.S. is a country with a lot of income that's basically driven by capital asset valuations, tax income. Americans actually report their stock returns, their capital gains, and they pay tax on it at a low rate, but they report it. And in fact, after the early 1980s, after the mid-1980s, we had a tax reform whose purpose was to capture that income on tax returns. I know about this because I was involved in writing the tax bill in my earlier life. But that was the whole point. When you get this big increase in capital gains type incomes, you're going to get an increase in inequality because the income is concentrated. Where's that first peak, this one here? You can time it, in fact, in monthly data to the month. It'll come out, well, I guess tax data don't get it off. It's in 2000. It's the peak of the NASDAQ it's exactly proportional to the scale of the NASDAQ's increase and fall. What's the next one here? 2007 is the peak of the real estate debacle of mortgage finance and construction. I'll come to that in a little while. Let's just look at some other types of countries. It's a broad measure. There's a, that one can describe it, so-called transition economies. And here's the Czechoslovakia, the Czech Republic. What's interesting about here, of course, they all show increases of inequality in the transition. Interesting, not the Germans don't, but the others do. But the relationship between gross and net is much more compressed in the transition economies. So these are countries with Hungary, Poland's a nice example, relatively weak welfare states post-transition, but still, as a result of communism, relatively tight wage distributions and income distributions. Not much difference between the gross and the net. In the Polish case, the consumption inequality is also available. There's Russia, messy data, but guess what? You can see the calamity of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And you can see also perceptibly a decline after the devaluation of the Ukraine, another calamity in 1991. Well, it's the same calamity as the collapse. So it's, these things are consistent across. Ooh, that's misspelled developing. Get rid of that. I did that on the train on the way up. So for a number of countries, we're continuing to add to this as we go along. Here's Argentina. Argentina is interesting because the literature, although our measures don't go quite that far yet, shows a significant decline beginning with the crisis in 2002. So there is some evidence here for the proposition of declining inequality in Latin America, which is the title of another recent and very important book, whose editor I will not embarrassed by mentioning him by name. So here's China, and we do have recent measures for China. There's a gap in our Chinese data, I'll come to that. But we are showing, and others are showing, some beginnings of a decline in inequality in China after a very messy increase in the 1990s, 80s and 90s. Here's India. India is interesting because India often gets taken in the literature thanks to the very low consumption inequality measures as a low inequality country. We don't think so. We think it's right up there. And there's a very recent Luxembourg Income Study paper in the latest Janet Warnick book, which has one measure for India, which is, turns out, just a couple of Gini points away from ours. I like that very much.
So is that in China then?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. India is higher than China. No, they're not surprising. There's much more poverty in India. To me, it makes sense. Having seen it, you know, drive-in from the airport test tells me that India is more unequal than China.
Yeah, the Indians, they always insist that the national central service measures consumption, therefore they're the only part of the country.
They're Scandinavian by their, yeah, if you make that comparison. I think it's complete nonsense, and anybody who walks down a street or drives down one in India can see that it's nonsense. Mexico, very messy data. Interestingly, the thing about Mexico is that all of the other numbers except ours are calculated from one source, which is INEGI. The Mexican official source, and different people just did different things, and you have to ask them what they did to get all those different numbers. But you can see one thing that's clear is that in a country without the same kind of welfare state that we are accustomed to, the measures of gross and net and market are all jumbled up. They're not stratified the way they are in the rich countries, which again, I think comes back to this point that if you are living in a poorer country, you have to have market income in order to have a household because there isn't Social Security income and so forth to nearly the same extent. And so people live with their parents and you would not expect the inequalities of pre and post tax to be all that different.
But then,
go back up here.
In this case, Mexico is one of the countries that analyzed when you basically underestimate the EH.
Yes, Mexico, Mexico, I say we're more or less consistent, but we underestimate, or the other sources overestimate, and I'm agnostic as to which that is. But most people would take the other sources because they're used to them. I don't know. I really don't know. I do have a problem with the estimates that put Mexico's inequality in the same league as Brazil's. The country just is not as divided as Brazil is between regions. And these numbers do, so the comparability question is just, at this point, a little bit vague, and I recognize that. I will show you, we're worse for other things. Here's some measures for Africa, and you can see very sparse measures in the literature. We are low for Botswana. We're pretty much on, for whatever it's worth, for the Côte d'Ivoire, on to the... here's Egypt, for where there are growth income measures for Egypt. In the early period, we do pretty well. We do pretty well, at least compared to some measures for Kenya, not otherwise. I can't make too much of these. Mauritius, for what it's worth, we track the measures in the literature. Morocco, there we are, just showing you what we have. Nigeria doesn't look too bad. And Tunisia, who knows? Well, there's a doubt. That's our African measures. I would not have thought that we would be in the ballpark compared to measures of gross income inequality for African countries because the manufacturing sectors are so small. Turns out, and because who knows, why would the model be the same? It turns out, well, even though the measures are very sparse, for what we have, that's not too bad. In fact, that's as good as we do with any other country. So it's probably not such a terrible thing. To rely on or to take our measures and at least use them tentatively even in these countries. Okay, where do we run into problems? Brazil, we're way low. We're way low below the literature, although we do pick up the trend. What's going on in Brazil, and it's characteristic of other large developing countries, it's a very big place. I would be willing to bet that if you took the divided Brazil along the Amazon into two countries, both of them would have lower inequality than the original, because you'd have a poor north and a rich south, and that's a major component. We're not going to pick that up well. I don't know for sure. I just say report the estimates once we calculate them, and you can judge how much of an adjustment you want to make. Colombia, I will offer a small prize to anyone who can make sense of the Colombian National Day. Pass on. South Africa, it's a substantial issue. South Africa is widely considered to be one of the most, certainly the most, possibly the most unequal large country in the world in the literature. We don't pick it up. What's going on? Another big country. It's obviously got a racial divide, which is a bit like the Amazon. You'd have two countries, one of which was all black and the other of which was all white. Both of them would be much more egalitarian than South Africa. Clearly. So that might be part of it, except that the industrial sector has both races in the workforce. So it's not entirely obvious to me what's going on. It might be land and income. It might be, you know, capital. There's gold, right? There's finance in South Africa, right? It's not surprising that in certain cases we are not in the ballpark of the literature. This is one of them. Okay, Thailand, that's one of the very few cases where we're not on trend. In fact, that's the only case that I've come across so far where our trend somehow is really, really apparently different from the rest of the literature. That's what a really measure that you wouldn't use and throw out would look like, it seems to me. Okay. What do I conclude from this? And I'm by no means ready to conclude. Do I have another 15 minutes? Yeah. First of all, that the literature is very messy. Secondly, that there are these big differences between the three classes of income inequality. And thirdly, if you want to focus on this measure of gross household income inequality, we do a pretty good job of estimating what the literature found. And this is very much post hoc comparisons where we do our estimates, and then we dug up the measures afterwards. We didn't know them beforehand. And none of our measures depend on the survey measures, except for the matching to the original Dynatrace score, which is a tiny subset of what has been up here in the Dynatrace system. And finally, of course, that we don't do very well with capital income. I want to just expand the range of things that we can do with this, because Gini coefficients on household income are not the only kind of inequality measures. And sometimes you can get more up-to-date or more comprehensive kinds of data or information by looking at other things. And so some examples are county average income in the United States from tax data, province and sector income data in China from the State Statistical Yearbook, regional and sector income across Europe from Eurostat, industrial wage inequality itself, the original data set, all of which give you the property, because the tile statistic can be added and aggregated and disaggregated, that you can look at the fine detail in very interesting ways. So for example, this just gives you a sense of how simple it is to compute the thing. All you need to compute is that component, which contains a population weight for each group, the average income of the group, and the average income of the whole population. Take the logs and sum. This I've already shown you is the US map, and I have arrows pointing to the two big capital asset booms that are not picked up in our data. They are picked up right there in measures of income across counties. Say 3,150 counties in the United States, and you have this these peaks, one of which is, I guess I didn't put any identifiers on it, one of which is the NASDAQ boom and the other of which is the real estate boom. If you look at which counties are responsible for this peak here, this one, the answer is five of them account for half of it. One of them's New York, New York, Manhattan, no surprise. Then there are three, San Francisco, Santa Clara, and San Mateo in Northern California, Silicon Valley, and one, King County in the state of Washington, which has the city of Seattle and the headquarters of Microsoft. What's going on? Stratospheric incomes attributed and reported by a very, very small number of people associated with a very small number of firms in a major boom in one particular sector, information technology. There are a few other things in the data, you can pick them out, but that is the dominant source of rising inequality in the United States in the 1990s. If you go into the 2000s, and you know, you can map this in all kinds of fun ways, these are the rich areas and the depressed ones or the poorer ones. And you can see, in addition to this Northern California and New York phenomenon, East Coast here, that's Manhattan right there. This is the contribution to inequality of each of these places. You can see these things that pop up that are clearly related to the real estate boom. Southern California, Florida, and so forth. And this is late 2000s, they crash after this data was collected. If you look at China, we can disaggregate the overall pattern of inequality in China, which begins rising in the early, in the late 80s here, this is 87, into two components, measure across provinces and a measure across sectors. And I'm gonna get a little brave here and call this one the Kuznets effect, and the second one, a Schumpeter effect, which is to say, in the early 2000s, you have a spreading out of income increases across provinces in China. The initial inequality is due to rises in Beijing, Shanghai, and Guangdong province. Then you add income gains start accelerating in neighboring places, Zhejiang, Tianjin, Fuzhou, Fujian. And as a result of that, the inequality peaks. And then the second place here that you get a peak in the central bed is with the crisis in 2008. And what's happening is that the very big gains in monopoly sectors, those called Schumpeterian sectors, finance, utilities, and transportation start to be curtailed. There's a collapse of activity, or decline of activity, which has an effect. And you add the two things up, and this is, I think, the first calculation of declining inequality in China beginning in 2008 overall. There's since been a second paper which tends to corroborate it, it was presented at WIDER in September. One of my collaborators, Beatrice, actually was there, heard it, so there are now a couple of indications that this is in fact the case. Here's Europe. And by Europe, I mean something which isn't calculated in national statistics. I mean the whole continent, right? With the measure of inequality being done across regions and sectors, 272 regions, six sectors, and you can see inequality declining into the crisis in 2007-2008. Why? Because the contribution to inequality of this sector is declining. What is the sector? It's the financial sector. Where are the incomes for that sector registered? Guess where? To a very significant extent, inner London. It's like one place out of 272 is driving a substantial part of the movement in this data, in this period. In the early phase of a financial crash, rich people's incomes fall quite a lot because they've been blown up in the previous period by the credit boom. And that's what's driving a lot of what we measure as income inequality. Okay. One last thing that I want to show you is the original wage data, and let's say these measures of income inequality across manufacturing. We had to, I'll skip over some of the playing around with the data that one has to do in order to update it, because the original data set's pretty messy, but you get big errors that you have to wash out, or little errors that you can fix by going in and finding a misplaced zero or a misplaced decimal point. But on the whole, the data, as we updated it through the early 2000s, tracked the data we had before. In some cases, it extended it quite well. In other cases, it wasn't so great, but China does at least have the same path as the Chinese data that I just showed you. Okay. What I can do with that, because there's so many observations, here we're talking about more than 4,000, is I can map them using changes over 6-year intervals. And what I did to fill in the maps was a little, I took 3-year averages for the start year, 3-year averages for the finish year, and then stratified the changes with a color code. So here is, whereas the previous set of maps showed you the levels of an inequality measure, these will show you the change with blues representing declines, actually with pale yellows also. No, that's blues representing declines and pale yellows to bright reds representing increases. Okay, so you can just pick up visually whether inequality is increasing or declining in this measure of pay inequality in a particular place. In the 1960s, there are lots of declining. Lots of places that are declining, not many which are increasing, to the extent they have in the data, 66 to 1970. One can watch this change as one moves into the 1970s. Here we have the period of the oil shocks. Oil-producing countries nicely show consistent declines. Consuming countries, importing countries show increases. Move into the 1980s, and guess what happens? The whole picture changes. And it changes in regionally specific ways. In particular, South America, very big increases. Is that a question back there? Go ahead. Oh, no, just stretch. Sorry. So one has the sign, and this is where I get to the point about the kind of global macroeconomics of inequality change. I would argue that if things were specific to the particular decisions of individual countries, you wouldn't see a pattern like this, the whole region changing all at once. Something must be happening to the region as a whole. For example, debt crisis, capital flight, internal collapse as a result of the common experience of a whole range of countries. And each one has, of course, its individual national experience, and the timing is not always the same, but there's a global macroeconomics at play, and there are places which are exempt. There's Cuba.
It seems to Europe, it's been in existence.
83 to 89, before the collapse, after the collapse, bang. First of all, we got data, and you can see massive increases throughout the former Soviet Union and Eastern Europe and now China, as well as data for East Africa, Mexico, and so forth in the 1990s. Couple of lost decades, generally speaking, rising inequality. But what's going to happen as we move into the 2000s? Well, it's still going up to 1999. That's the peak of the technology boom in the US. And then 1997, Asian crisis, Russian crisis. And we move into the early 2000s, this is through 2006. And this is 2003 to 2008. So, although inequality has gone up a lot through the 1990s, in the 2000s, there seems to be some reason to believe that if the impetus is still the same, and if the model is still good, which I think it is, that there's a general pattern of stabilization and even decline. Now you can imagine, commodity prices improve, Russia recovers, and the inequalities that characterize the transition period in Russia begin to decline. And guess what? Putin has an 80% approval rating. The phenomenon in China I've already described, and one can, I think, also identify all the Latin American data. I guess I'm still discussing problems with getting it all over the map. I think we're in line with the finding that over this period we've seen declines in inequalities in Latin America. It doesn't mean that inequality is still high. It may be very high by historical standards, but it does suggest that there's nothing completely inexorable about the rise, that conditions can change. Lower interest rates, higher commodity prices, stronger growth in developing countries may produce declines of inequality that will eventually pick up in the data, and we should be wary of attributing those declines to some comprehensive feature of the system. It may well have to do much more with the international policy environment, with the retreat from neoliberal ideology and the reestablishment in some places of something that approaches a developmental strategy of one kind or another. One can talk about what those policies might be, and it may simply be geophysical conditions, higher oil prices produce reductions of inequality in places that produce the stuff, one gets out of the examination of data of this kind some hints about where to look for explanations of what's going on in the world. And if you want to look more, the website is here. I named my very talented collaborators. All the data sets are there, lots and lots of working papers, 68 of them. Including the most recent one, which has all those charts and 31,000 words of so far of source notes describing where the information came from. So it's pretty much accessible, pretty simple to emulate or to borrow from. Feel free to make whatever use of it you find useful. Thanks very much.